You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host Per Foggering interviews professor and activist Rania Masri about Syria, beyond the falsehoods and false choices, a reaction to Obama's speech. The phone lines will be open for your calls. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features more analysis of the situation in Syria with an extended interview with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes John Salvit to talk about his food forest and growing unusual fruits and his grafting experiments. And Quince. He knows Quince.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. Triangle Productions and KBOO Community Radio are proud to present Kiss of the Spider Woman. The Oregon premiere of this 7-time Tony Award-winning musical will be at The Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The show will run from September 5th through the 29th. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Foggering, and the program is Political Perspectives, and we're going to talk about Syria with Rania Masri, who is a professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Balamand in Lebanon, but she's currently visiting in the U.S. Rania Masri, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, and hello to you all.
Oh, welcome.
Actually, good morning to you all.
Well, it is morning here. I don't know.
Yes.
Well, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, there's so much spin and disinformation to untangle. Where do we begin? We're talking about Syria. Where do we start?
Yes.
Did you hear Obama's speech last night?
Yes, I did hear. I was able to stomach President Obama's speech yesterday with some difficulty. I thought he did quite a good job at remaining consistent to the binary perspectives that he's been telling us all in the States and giving us. So he has remained true to his campaign of misinformation, and he fulfilled that in his speech, very much so.
Well, one reaction was from a guy I know who's a peace activist, actually a presidential candidate some time ago. He called it a weak speech. Writer Pepe Escobar, he says that Russia threw Obama a lifeline, and he caught it. And apparently they're the ones who thought up that whole idea anyway about Syria giving up its supposed weapons of gas. So it seems to me that... I didn't listen to it. I was at a meeting, but I read the transcript, and he One thing that struck me is he says, we know that Syria is gassing its own people. We know. Never tells you how we know or what the facts are or details, but just we know and you sort of have to trust us.
And yeah, then, I want to add to that that he didn't even define who the we is. Because the dossier that has been presented, you know, allegedly, there's this big dossier of evidence that they have, is not actually from the intelligence departments in this country. It was presented by the White House itself. And even intelligence experts recognize that it's actually a cut-and-paste job from intelligence documents.
Oh.
So that's one issue, is the we here is the White House and not the U.S. intelligence agencies.
It's a very small, it's not a very inclusive we then, is it?
Well, no, it's quite a small we. Mm-hmm. And the second issue that also raises significant questions as to the level of, quote, evidence that they have to assert this knowledge that they have is statements that have been made by Congressman Alan Grayson from Florida, in which he's gone on record as saying that our administration wants our congressional representatives to trust but not to verify because they've been denied the classified documents themselves. So we understand that our administration may not want us Americans to see the classified documents for whatever reason, but under what logic could they deny our congressional representatives that critical information unless they themselves know that the critical information is lacking?
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of figure that when they're hiding something that much, I think you're entitled to believe the worst.
Yes.
It's the principle of logic. And I know that in other cases, talking about covering up information this whole area of NSA eavesdropping on people, our own Senator Ron Wyden can't get information, and he says that the information he has, he can't talk about it. All he can do is kind of hint that it's really horrible.
Yes, yes, which, again, speaks a great deal that we living in the land of the free are right now the most watched communities in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We have become that country where we, the citizens and residents and civilians living in the United States, have become the most surveilled.
Well, you know, one thing that I take out of this speech and the whole sort of stuff surrounding it is that, the people have stopped a bigger war, at least so far. I mean, from what I heard in the news this morning, the administration is going gung-ho in every way they can, but so far we have prevented a bigger war. And it's interesting the political lineup that did this. It's not just the peace community on the left. It's sort of there is a peace community on the right, and there are a lot of more libertarian right wingers, and for whatever reason they don't like this kind of war either. So it's between these two groups we managed to prevent this war from happening.
Well, I mean, I believe that the statements made by President Obama yesterday, his conclusion that he would not ask the Congress to vote on the war resolution, was completely to be expected, given that he did not have the votes in the House, and he arguably did not even have the votes in the Senate. And that would have been a real embarrassment for the president, for him to ask Congress to vote on a war resolution and then to be denied that vote. And then particularly when there have been rumblings in the House that were the president to be denied the vote and then to go ahead with his bombing campaign, there are those in the House of Representatives that would then call for his impeachment because of the violation of the Constitution as they read it. So given all of this, yes, we have a lot to recognize, and for many of us who've been active on this issue in this country and have been active on numerous other anti-war issues, this is a time for us to pat ourselves on the back, but also to recognize the absolute importance of working across political spectrum and working across different organizations on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously, it's critical to recognize that the bombing campaign has not been stopped. The bombing campaign has simply been tabled. And now there are still those forces, be they the military-industrial complex, be it the Saudi-funded and Saudi-led so-called external Syrian opposition, be it numerous other factors that will continue to call for a bombing campaign against Syria. So this is time for us just to take a little bit of a breather, but not that long, because mm-hmm. we still need to valiantly organize for peace. And the third point I want to say is, although there hasn't been a bombing campaign now, I mean, there won't be a bombing campaign now against Syria, it doesn't mean that Syria has reached peace or stability. It doesn't mean that the Syrian people are doing well. It just means that they're under less of a threat than they were previously. So also, in the name of recognizing that we want to stand in solidarity with Syrians, we also need to work very effectively to get all parties to the negotiating table, to work to halt the flood of arms that are flooding Syria, be it throughout all its porous borders and again being funded by the Saudis, and at the same time to encourage increased funding for the desperately needed humanitarian aid for the 6 million Syrians in need.
Okay, I think we have a caller on the line. Harry,
yes.
Welcome.
I'd like to first make a comment, then I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
The first comment is, as a progressive, I don't trust John Kerry, because in the 2004 election, when he said he will make sure every vote will be counted, he abdicated and he didn't do it.
Okay.
So I don't, and as for Obama, I don't trust him either, because when he was first elected in 2008, he mentioned that he would close Guantanamo. He's the commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces. All he has to do is say the word, and Guantanamo would be closed.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, there's torture and probably murder going on down there.
Well, he says he tried, and the Republicans won't let him. Now, I don't know if that if that works for you, but
no,
that's what he
he's
says.
He's commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that doesn't work. And then next is... He actually conversed with Gaddafi. He actually talked with Gaddafi for about an hour. A year later, he murders him, his son, and his two grandchildren. So kind of think he should be going to The Hague for trial. Both presidents think the international community and international law, they can do whatever they want.
Well, it's funny how a lot of our former allies wind up on our naughty list. I'm thinking of, going back to Manuel Noriega in Panama, Saddam Hussein, who we actually helped to his first job assassinating a leader in Iraq back in 59, and lots of others. You know, they are our allies until for some reason we turn on them. Actually, the Assad government was our ally also. CIA sent people there to be tortured. So it's interesting. So what is your question? Because we got a couple other callers,
okay,
too.
Okay, sure. So, the question will be your guest thoughts of the 9/11 truth movement.
Okay, we will ask. What do you think, Rania? What do you think of the 9/11 truth movement?
And thank you.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I really don't know that much about the 9/11 truth movement to be able to speak adequately on that. I do want to speak about Guantanamo, though, because if we notice the language that President Obama said he wanted to close it, and in essence, he wanted to move it to another location, and that was what he was not able to do. And I think, though, as people of conscience, what we should be asking for is that all those detainees, all those prisoners in Guantanamo need to be released. They need to be released. They have been in captivity without trial, without evidence, for a very long time. They have been suffering numerous different kinds of torture. There is no reason to hold them. I mean, not only is it criminal and unethical, but there really is no reason to hold them. Many of them have been shown to be innocent of any alleged ties with terrorists, and yet they remain in captivity. So rather than asking for Guantanamo to be closed or to be moved, what we need to be strongly asking for is for all the prisoners in Guantanamo to be released.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why don't we go on to our next caller? Mitch is on the line.
Hi, Per.
Hi.
I was wondering if, Rania, your host, could comment on an observation I made on the KBOO website. It was September of 2012 that Gudaz Ekdadari, on your very excellent One Land, Many Voices program.
Voices of the Middle East.
Right, yes. Yes, he had a program about the blogger up in Seattle, Richard Silverstein, who was taking leaks from an Israeli who was working for the CIA, spying on Israel, actually, because he was concerned that the Israeli leadership was trying to coax America into attacking Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very prominent Israeli named Shammai Leibovitz from one of the more prominent Israeli families was actually spying on Israel. That's how concerned he was about where the leadership of Netanyahu had gotten to. And it came up in September of 2012 that Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, his coalition partner, began using this red line strategy in public rhetoric vis-a-vis Iran. And Hillary Clinton refused to get boxed into red line. She said that is just something that backs you into a place where you can't do anything diplomatically. And here we are a year later, and Barack Obama has adopted the red line strategy, which is how he got boxed into allowing a bloody dictator like Bashar Assad to go on Charlie Rose and make Bashar Assad look like the diplomat and the American look like the warmonger. Can you have Rania comment on this whole red line strategy?
Okay, yes.
Yes, you raise an excellent point, and I find myself in agreement with Hillary Clinton, which is a very rare situation for me, that a red line strategy is completely not diplomatic. There needs always to be back roads that are open. But yet even that, when President Obama made that first red line comment, he made it late last year. And since that comment, the rebels on the ground in Syria every week accuse the Syrian government of committing one kind of chemical weapons attack or another. And they continue to claim this accusation, by the way, that has not in any way been verified by the United Nations or by independent agencies. What I find to be interesting is when President Obama decides that the Syrian government has crossed this red line, and the two times that he has talked about them crossing the red line, one in early June and one just recently, have actually been when the Syrian army was close to achieving a military victory on the battlefield in Syria. And I think this speaks volumes as to the ulterior objective of the U.S. government. Because if the U.S. government were truly interested in chemical weapons, per se, and truly interested in deterrence and making sure there are no chemical weapons, they would have encouraged U.N. weapons inspectors to remain longer in Syria, and they didn't. They would have tried valiantly to discover who amongst all the warring parties in Syria is actually using chemical weapons, and they're not, because they remain consistent that it can only be the Syrian government, failing to recognize reports by the United Nations which say, and I quote, that there are, quote, strong suspicions that the rebels themselves may have used or have access to sarin gas. So again, if the objective is chemical weapons. However, when we look at statements made by Secretary of State John Kerry in numerous Friends of Syria conferences, and I'm Friends of Syria in quotes, of course, because they are neither friends of Syria nor friends at all, but at those conferences, Secretary of State John Kerry made it clear that the objective is to balance the power in the battlefield in Syria. And again, so when we notice when the Syrian army gains strength, that is when the rhetoric against it from the U.S. government tends to increase.
Well, regarding these chemical weapons, as a recent story just came out, there were two Italian hostages who were released, and they are saying that they overheard, they were hostages of the Syrian rebels, and they overheard the rebel speaking in English to somebody on the phone about false flag plans. And then also recently, the German newspaper Bild am Sonntag said that phone intercepts show that Bashar Assad was refusing to use gas as a weapon. He was being asked to by presumably his military commanders, and he refused. So there's a lot to be investigated here.
Yeah, and I would add on to that the Russians have been claiming that what has happened in Ghouta was actually that numerous questions need to be raised. Let me be more accurate. The questions that they have raised are about the pictures that we have been shown. And if you notice, the children have been separated from the parents. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of odd when we look at a chemical weapons attack or any other attack. You would not imagine that there would be this separation. We don't know why the bodies are placed as they are. We don't know why they look the way they do, but they don't really look like people who have suffered from a chemical weapons attack. Mm-hmm. More importantly, the pro-opposition source, the Syrian Human Rights Observatory, which has been the main source of information on the number of fatalities and identifies itself as pro-opposition, they have claimed that there have been 505 people that have been killed in that Ghouta attack. And yet, President Obama and Kerry and numerous others continue to claim that more than 1,400 people have been killed in that attack. Now, that is a discrepancy of almost 1,000. You know, it's mm-hmm. a significant discrepancy in the number of fatalities, and I think that alone should raise questions of credibility as to what is actually happening in Ghouta.
Well, this is Political Perspectives, and my guest is Professor Rania Masri. We're talking about Syria, and if you want to call us up, the phone number is 503-231-8187, and I think we have a caller on the line. LJ is on the line. Morning, LJ.
Hey, Pierre, how are you?
Oh, doing okay.
Good deal. Thank you for opening up the dialogue. Your last caller kind of touched on the Israeli role in this travesty. It is my understanding that AIPAC had a couple of hundred lobbyists on the ground in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
To try and convince certain members of Congress to vote for action in Syria.
They went all out, yes.
They really went all out. Second point, it's also my understanding that the intercepted message was given to the USA by the Israelis. So is that intrusion in fact also true?
Well, that's interesting.
And the third point I'd like to make is this great humanitarian tragedy that has occurred ever since this thing started. I understand that there are 2 million refugees now in Lebanon and in Turkey and in Jordan, and these countries are being overwhelmed by the amount of refugees, not to mention the impact that it's having on the children of Syria who are totally traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people are forced to leave their homes, to leave their villages under the threat of a horrific attack by the USA. And I'm wondering, being that the USA is not going to bomb for the moment, whether they're going to give any money to Lebanon and Turkey and Jordan to alleviate the crisis that is happening in those countries.
Well,
and I would love to take my answers off the air.
Well, I don't know. They should certainly help undo all this damage. But Ronnie, what do you think?
Well, there's so many points that the guest raised that I think are excellent. And with regards to AIPAC, what's most powerful here is not only did AIPAC send 250 quote-unquote consultants to flood Congress on one particular day, but that it was President Obama that specifically asked Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to then ask AIPAC to go in. So we have the President of the United States asking a foreign leader for support in influencing the Congress.
Oh, my.
This in and of itself is huge, and it violates so many aspects of what this country should stand for. That's one issue. Second, yes, most definitely, the alleged intercepted call did come from Israeli intelligence, and I think that also speaks as to its credibility and its authenticity, given that the Israelis are not in any way, shape, or form a neutral participant in this proxy war, civil war.
Well, the point it makes, I guess, is that Assad was asked to use chemical weapons, and he refused, so...
Well, actually, that intercepted call that is being raised as evidence by Kerry and Obama, they don't go into details as what actually transpired on that call.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But all we know is they're claiming there's an intercepted call that's of evidence, and that intercepted call was from the Israeli intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that they don't even tell us the details of it. Now, with regards to the humanitarian horror, yes, most definitely. We have one-third of all Syrians are now displaced, one-third, 4 million of whom are internally displaced, 2 million of whom have become refugees. And 1 million of those refugees are now children. 1 million. Many a times we find children crossing the borders into Lebanon and other borders with no close relatives with them. So the situation is completely horrific and completely heartbreaking from a humanitarian perspective. And what makes it ironic is when President Obama, we heard him yesterday, you know, speak in anguish over Syrian children, which, again, is so deeply offensive because of his various other positions. But at the same time, the United Nations has been pleading for funds to take care of these children, to take care of these refugees. And their pleadings for funds have continuously gone under-supported and underfunded. So somehow the United States is managing to find funds to commit to a possible 60 to 90-day bombing campaign against Syria, a bombing campaign that would most definitely, unquestionably, kill children, kill civilians, and increase the number of refugees, and it wants to do that all allegedly because of its love for children, and yet it fails to find the funds that are needed to actually take care of the children on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we have another caller. Jack is on the line. Welcome.
Yes. Segueing from your discussion of children. I think, I don't know if you've seen this one yet. I mean, there's so much stuff popping up now on this whole issue. And the most disturbing thing recently that I found was the report that Syrian children kidnapped by rebels identified as gas victims. From several different sources, it remains to be verified, of course. But the story goes like this, that rebels working in Latakia, a Alawite village, had kidnapped a number of women and children, over 100, in the last a few weeks ago. They disappeared. No one had any contact with them whatsoever. They started recognizing them as the images went on the internet of the victims of the gas attack. They started recognizing their families.
Mm. What can we find out more?
This is the most disturbing thing uh-huh. I've come across in all of the stuff that's coming out that's pointing toward a false flag, that's pointing toward total deception as a provocation. And what we also have here at this time is one of the precedents. We have a precedence on the world stage. For the first time, a world leader has come out and accused another government of the world as supporting, as being, as their surrogates, having committed a false flag provocation, a tragic false flag provocation to start a military intervention.
What can we find out more about that, about the kidnapped children?
I'm looking at a website right now called truthseeker.co.uk. If you Google Truth Seeker, you'd probably find it. Mm-hmm. Truth Seeker, Syrian children kidnapped by rebels.
Oh, okay.
That comes up pretty quick, I think. There's a number of websites that are reporting this. They're mirroring, of course. It's the same report.
Mm-hmm.
But it's circulating. And again, the other thing I mentioned was, for the very first time, we have Vladimir Putin accusing the NATO member states and their Gulf Arab surrogates of colluding and instigating this blatant false flag.
Mm-hmm.
And usually international leaders of first line states never do this. I mean, they may think it. They may mm-hmm. have intelligence in the background that's informing them, but they never come right out and say it.
Right.
And this is a severe precedence. So I will just listen off the air for your guests' comments on these things, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, yes, it is very, very powerful, and I agree with him that there has become an international precedence here, particularly in the very statements that Putin has made with regards to the U.S. administration on this issue. When we look to this accusation that these children were kidnapped and placed in there, it does fit with the pictures that we have seen, because, again, if we notice the pictures, that the children are placed separately from the adults, and were this to have been just a regular chemical weapons attack against a civilian community, there would be no reason for the children not to be with their families during the time of that attack. So that claim that has been made, that these children were actually kidnapped from Aleppo, which is a coastal Syrian city, and brought to this community and killed in that way by members of the Free Syrian Army, if not other rebels, does fit in line with the pictures, and it does fit in line with the statements that have been made by the newly released Belgian and Italian hostages.
Well, this is Political Perspectives, and as you can understand, we are talking about Syria. Before I get to the next caller, I would like to quickly fill in a little background on this. You know, we are sort of under the impression from the mainstream media that this Syrian uprising just kind of happened all of a sudden. Well, that's not quite true. Back in 1949, the U.S. overthrew a president of Syria. His name was Shukri al-Kuwatli, and he was ousted in 1949, and the reason was that he had blocked a proposed pipeline from Arabia, Saudi Arabia. He also refused to sign an armistice with Israel, and he also tolerated communists as a legal political party in Syria. So he was kicked out, a convicted criminal named Husni al-Zaim was installed, and he allowed the pipeline, and he was himself arrested 5 months later. Then in 57, the U.S. and Britain apparently cooked up a plot to overthrow a government of Syria, including assassinations. It never really got off the ground. Then in 2001, we have General Wesley Clark was visiting the Pentagon, and he was told that this by a fellow general there that this plan had come down from Rumsfeld's office that the U.S. would take out 7 countries in 5 years. And one of those countries was Syria. Others were Lebanon and leading up to Iran. Well, the timeline has been extended, but the plan apparently is still in effect. Then in 2007, Seymour Hersh wrote an article for The New Yorker about redirection, where the U.S. Sort of focused all its attention on basically overthrowing the government of Iran, and that the Saudis would sponsor Sunni extremists all over the region. These are people like al-Qaeda, which the Saudis sponsored in Afghanistan with U.S. acquiescence, and that the U.S. would okay Saudi moves against Syria. So there is a background of what is going on now. That didn't just happen out of the blue. So now let's go on to our next caller. Lori's on the line. Welcome, Lori.
Yeah, I think much of what I had to ask was just answered, but I was curious to know when Assad became a monster, because I don't remember hearing that term dumped on him before this insurrection. And if 100,000 young guys went to downtown Portland and took over the streets, we'd have our police without a permit, we'd have our police force, and we've even formed a fusion center here along with the rest of the country to stop such a thing of occurring. These nice peaceful demonstrators had access to enough weapons to start a civil war soon after Assad tried to stop it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious about when he became a monster.
I don't know.
He stopped doing what he was told, maybe?
Yeah, it could be. Rania, when did Bashar become a monster?
Well, the rhetoric that has been placed against Bashar al-Assad has definitely been increasing. So now he's being compared to Hitler, for example, which is completely ludicrous when we look at what are his capabilities and his objectives. They began to increase during the so-called uprising civil war proxy war in Syria. And if we remember, actually, I'm not sure how much attention it got to the mainstream press here, but right when there was the Tunisian uprising, during that time, Erdogan from Turkey was meeting with Bashar al-Assad and was trying to convince him to allow Muslim brotherhoods in Syria and to allow other kinds of political representation by religious political parties, which is a violation in Syria. And so from then, we started to have these rumblings. I agree with what you're saying, and we need to recognize that the Syrian regime, both Hafez al-Assad, the father, and Bashar al-Assad, the son, have been allies of the United States on so many different fronts. They did participate in rendition. They did participate in the Gulf War against Iraq. They have participated in economic and political brutality. However, they have refused to stop supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is the main, if not the only, military force that is able to stand against Israel. And they have refused to stop supporting them. And they have refused in one way or another to fully acquiesce their economy to a more liberal, neoliberal agenda, although the son, Bashar al-Assad, has been transforming the economy from more of a social protectorate to more of a neoliberal one. I also want to add that when we look at what we consider to be revolution, uprising, civil war, whatever language we want to give to what's happening in Syria, that there are different factions to it. There is a segment of the Syrian population that have been participating from even before 2011 in civil society transformations and putting pressure as civil society members on the government to transform it from one of being politically repressive to one that is accountable to its population. There is that portion of nonviolent uprisings that have occurred and continue to occur. Mm-hmm. Now, there also is a civil war that is occurring with members of the Syrian army that did defect and did become more and more and more extreme. There is that also occurring. But then there also is a proxy war occurring with many, many, many foreign-led rebel brigades in Syria that are being led now. Actually, the participation is that there's more than 43 different nationalities right now fighting in Syria. And a few weeks ago, there was a report of yet another rebel brigade being organized by non-Arabs. These are being organized by folks from the Caucasus region. And so we're seeing a flood of all these different aspects. And when we put it into focus, we recognize, as is supported by the State Department, that the most equipped and most militarized of all these armed brigades and the loudest voices on the ground in Syria are actually the voices of al-Nusra Front, a terrorist organization, and those to the right of it. What has been lost amidst all this crisis have been the voices of the Syrian people themselves, who have been struggling for a very long time to transform their country into a democratic one.
Well, you know, you raised that point about the liberalizing the economy, and I just want to add a quick little footnote, not go into it too much, but recently Ellen Brown, who's been writing about public banks, wrote an article about banking in Syria, and their form of banking does not charge interest, and this greatly offends the world bankers who make their living off of exorbitant interest. Well, Ellen Brown wrote this article, and so I invite all our listeners to get to their computers and look it up. I'm not going to talk about it here. She talks about it much better than I can. But anyway, I just want to turn you on to that. Ellen Brown has written a recent article on banking in Syria and what that has to do with this war. And so now I think we have another caller. Damir is on the line. Welcome.
Yeah, this is Samir.
Oh, Samir. Okay, good.
You know, I just want to talk about our 9/11, you know, now we the anniversary of the 14 years of 9/11 in Chile, and what happened in Egypt, it's exactly a repetition of what had happened in Chile in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And the American CIA incited the monsters in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to overthrow our first elected president in the history of Egypt. It talks volumes about the hypocrisy of the American government from the inception of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not very fond of Bashar al-Assad and Hafez al-Assad. I think he could have stopped it from the beginning. I think what's happening in Syria, it's all sides, all parties are guilty, and Bashar al-Assad, with his lack of imagination, he allowed what I call snakes and scorpions to get into Syria.
Your phone connection is not coming across very well. It's hard to hear you. Could I?
What I'm saying, the hypocrisy about when the American president talk about justice and children. It's a hypocrisy. What about the injustice in Egypt?
Well, why don't we ask our... Okay, we get your point about that. Why don't we ask our guest about that? Rania, what about the parallels between the overthrow of Allende in Chile and the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt?
I mean, one can claim that both were overthrown and that both have semblances of a military coup. However, I think the analogy stops there.
Uh-huh.
Because when we look at Salvador Allende, the man represented and was a true emblem of a socialist agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a long campaign against him to make the economy of Chile suffer. And when people did not rise up in response to the economic brutality that was forced upon Chile by U.S. banks and corporations, then the CIA had to actually get involved directly in Chile and cause the massive attack on the palace grounds in Chile and directly replace this democratically elected socialist president with General Pinochet, who then led a very long, barbaric episode on Chile.
Mm-hmm.
So in Chile, we see direct U.S. involvement. In Egypt, I don't believe we have direct U.S. involvement as much as we have indirect U.S. involvement. And although, you know, one can argue that Mohamed Morsi was a democratically elected president, I would very strongly hesitate to compare him in any way, shape, or form to Salvador Allende.
Mm-hmm. What about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood? You know, in some areas they seem to be regarded as an enemy of imperial interests, and in other cases they are being used by them. I mean, it's a little paradoxical.
It is, and there's a lot of complexity on the scene in Egypt, and there's a lot of confusion as to what is actually happening. We know that the Muslim Brotherhood has committed crimes in Egypt. That is unquestionable. We also know that the Egyptian military has committed crimes in Egypt, and that is also unquestionable. And there may even be third parties that are committing crimes and placing them on the responsibility of either the former or the secondary partner. Amidst all of this in Egypt, we do have an ongoing struggle for democracy and for accountability, and it is ongoing in very difficult forms, but it is ongoing. But yes, the Muslim Brotherhood themselves claim to represent a larger than a national agenda, and therein lies one of their main problems right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we have another caller. Celine, you're on the line.
Yeah, I'm on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question to Rania. First question is, I read recently, actually yesterday, in the Huffington Post, that's a British newspaper, about the rebels using children. Since you were talking about children, they were using children in weapons factory, and in particular, there was a child, his name is Issa, and he's barely 10 years old, and he was photographed, numerous photographs, sexing weapons, including missile launchers and other weapons. Now, is the American government, or is Kerry, Secretary Kerry, or Obama himself, are they blind to those Putin or those media, and are they choosing purposely to just look at the crisis from one perspective, since we have seen all their decisions have are directed at a certain angle? They're not looking at the wider picture of the whole crisis in Syria. And my second question is regarding as well the American government. Now, I believe if the president, God forbid, choose to launch a strike on Syria, the American people, shouldn't they, apart from just calling your Congress member or your House of Rep or any politician and advising you not to and voicing your opinion, shouldn't the American people themselves choose to do more substantial action than just going to the street and protesting against strike? I mean, isn't there any sort of solution to preventing a strike?
Okay, Ron, did you get those questions?
Yes, I did, and I'll try to answer both. Mm-hmm. I most definitely agree with you. I mean, the so-called rebels in Syria have been projecting even the image of children carrying weapons and participating in the bloodshed, children as young as 10 and 11, most definitely. And for anyone, you can find these pictures on YouTube. I'm not sure if they're available in English, but they're most definitely available in Arabic, as presented by the rebel brigades themselves, because they seem to think this is a positive aspect. But I think when we're asked questions such as, does Secretary of State Kerry not see these crimes? Does he not recognize the crimes committed by the rebels and the crimes committed by Al-Nusra Front and other terrorists in Syria, of which there are many, many crimes? I think that assumes that Kerry and Obama and others actually care about the people of Syria. And that when Obama went out on television yesterday and he spoke about his anguish at seeing children in pain, that he actually meant it. And I argue very much that they could not care less about the Syrian people as a people. They could not care less about these children. They only use examples when they fulfill their own particular framing of their own particular objective. Because were this government to be sincere about caring for children, then this government would not be conducting drone strikes against more than a dozen countries that have resulted in the death of more than 3,000 people. The latest numbers, possibly 70 of these 3,000 people may have been suspected terrorists, and all the others are civilians. And of course, if the U.S. government were truly concerned with the Syrian population, then they would not be turning a blind eye to the fact that, according to them, 15% of the rebel brigades are terrorists whose mission is to exterminate all non-Muslims in Syria. So their objective is not humanitarian in any way, shape, or form, and we need to be a lot more vigilant in reframing the conflict in Syria as it is more accurately to be reframed. As to your question as to what can people do, calling Congress representatives is vital, and we tend to minimize that, but it is important. However, as you stated, it's not enough. And I think what we need to be recognizing as an anti-war movement and as people of conscience is that this is a very, very long battlefield. We need to maintain our organizing, not just come to the forefront right when our representatives talk about war and then go back to other issues when they're not talking about war. We've been facing the same crises in the United States for decades. And we need to be organized very effectively and very efficiently across political spectrum and across numerous other issues. We need to be able to tie what is happening in Syria with what is happening to military families in the United States, with what is happening in the incarceration of the largest percentage of our population in world history. Connect all these issues, connect foreign policy to domestic policy, and we have the information to do that. And then we need to organize more effectively. It is way too premature right now for us to be calling for a strike solely because we do not have the organizational capability to do so. But at this moment, when the vast majority of Americans, vast majority, are standing in opposition to a bombing campaign, for a number of different reasons, mind you, but they are in opposition to a bombing campaign, this gives significant potential for the anti-war movement to be speaking to these different communities, to bring home to them how a war outside our borders is actually a war inside our borders at the same time.
Okay, this is Political Perspectives, and my guest is Rania Masri, and we're talking about Syria. The number to call is 503-231-8187. And I have a question. Now, you are a professor in the environmental field, and I've been reading that part of this problem in Syria was caused by this horrendous drought. And something similar is happening in Egypt. Egypt not too long ago was able to sort of feed itself, but at the behest of the IMF, they've been paving over their fertile farmland along the Nile in order to build cities, and now Egypt is going hungry. And it's like this can only get worse with global warming happening. I got in front of me right now, I have a map here, and a real red hot spot is the entire, well, the worst part is in Syria and Jordan, part of Saudi Arabia and Israel. And so this is going to get worse. I mean, it just, do you foresee that?
It's unquestionable. Climate change has already arisen. It is here. We have seen it in Syria, where Syria experienced several years of consecutive drought, which was ahistoric to the Syrian environment. We have seen it in numerous other communities, and of course we've seen it in the United States. Climate change is already upon us. And many scientists argue that it is too late to change the tide because we have exceeded the tipping point. However, what magnifies the danger of climate change on our agricultural system is our agricultural system itself. The fact that we continue to support genetically modified organisms, that we continue to support these large monocultures and large agricultural plantations that do not allow themselves ecologically the ability to adapt to these changes. And then in addition to having a very destructive agricultural system, we also, on top of that, have a destructive economic system with not enough support giving to farmers, per se, and the whole system of government, of economy that continues to encourage more and more rather than to encourage wiser and wiser. We saw that in Syria with the consecutive droughts in Syria, coupled with the bad agricultural policies in Syria, coupled with the bad economic policies in Syria. These three issues then led to one of the first internal displacements in Syria, which occurred before the uprising. It occurred in 2010, was when many farmers had to leave their communities. And by leaving their communities, many of these farmers then also participated in the uprising. And that's one of the reasons that Syria has been regarded as an example of how climate change can influence the stability of a country. But I think we need to recognize, and here I am speaking as an environmental scientist, mm-hmm. that although climate change is horrendous, most definitely, and its consequences are going to be transformative, what makes the consequences of climate change all the more difficult is our agricultural policies and our economic policies. And those two things we can most definitely transform a lot quicker and a lot more powerfully than we can possibly right now protect ourselves from climate change per se.
That would be a whole different program, which I would love to do sometime. But it seems to me that the empire is creating these horrendous conditions. And then when they erupt, then the empire tries to take advantage of them for its own evil purposes. But anyway, I think we have another caller on the line. Tawasi's on the line. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. And also thanks for facilitating this dialogue. I'm so appreciative for KBOO. And as soon as I have any money, I'm giving it straight to you guys.
Oh, good.
I wanted to mention the effects of military industrialization and the effects on the economy and the fiscal irresponsibility. Everyone knows it's immoral to explode people. That's why in Portland we don't explode people. But the president apparently has some moral conflict with that. He explodes people just about every day. But the immoral part about it, beyond the obvious death, is how much money is made off of it. And I feel like as a citizen of the world, we need to really hold the feet of our officials to the fire over taking money to, explode people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's completely irreprehensible to, as a nation, to watch as war profiteers degrade our country and the country of the people who they're exploding. what I propose doing is taking a look at the open records that we have and saying, hey, you were interacting with this lobbyist, which lobbies on behalf of this missile maker,
mm-hmm.
and we're not standing by anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to stand right in your office until you give that money back to the missile maker, and until you do that, we're going to consider you a war profiteer because mm-hmm. you took blood money.
Well, there's lots of
That's un-American.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of companies doing that right up the river from here. They are making drones, and then you have big companies like Raytheon, and I'm sure you find the Carlyle Group in there someplace or other. I mean, there's, the thing about empires is they impoverish the people in other countries. They impoverish most of the people here at home, but they make a few people very, very rich. That's the way empires work. Do we have that caller still there? Oh, okay. Well, Ronnie, do you have any comment on that?
I mean, I agree with the caller completely, and to bring the discussion back to Syria, one of the mm-hmm. consequences of a bombing campaign on Syria would be a significant inflation in the oil prices internationally and, of course, domestically here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at the inflation of the oil prices, we can see clearly who would benefit and who would suffer from that.
Yeah, I think the price of Brent crude, which is sort of the benchmark oil, I think it got up as high as $117 a barrel not too long ago. That is really getting up there.
Yes.
But do we have another caller on the line? Yes, we do. Mahendra.
Yes, okay. I'm going to just cut to the chase here. You guys have been dancing around it, but there's a great article on Russia. I think it's Russia Today, RT.com.
Mm-hmm.
Eight reasons the New World Order hates Syria.
Okay.
Let me just run through them here real quick.
Sure.
Syria's central bank is state-owned and controlled.
We mentioned that in an article by Ellen Brown on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Then Syria has no IMF debt.
I think Ellen Brown mentioned that too. That's a good one, yes.
Syria has banned GMO.
Uh-huh.
Syria's population is supposedly well-informed about the New World Order. They have massive oil and gas reserves. They unequivocally and clearly oppose Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the last secular Muslim state in the Middle East. Wait, there's one more. Proudly maintains and protects its political and cultural national identity. So they ain't coming out. It's not what it seems. This story about the people being kidnapped and gassed, that's the first I've heard of it. Very disturbing. But they want Armageddon going on over there, and we have to do everything we can to stop it. That's all I got to say. Thanks for the show.
Okay, well, Rania, what do you think about those 8 points?
Many of them are true, and maybe all of them are true, but I think one of the primary reasons that there is this push against Syria, in addition to the oil and the gas and the water and the geostrategic location and the banking and all these other issues, is the fact that the Syrian government has remained the main supporter of Hezbollah in Lebanon. Not so much because of what the Syrian government itself has done to Israel, because the border between Syria and Israel, border between Syria and occupied Palestine, if I may speak more accurately, the border, you know, of the Golan Heights, which has been occupied since 67, is one of the calmest borders between Syria, you know, the one of the calmest borders that Israel has. So in that sense, Syria hasn't led a valiant fight against Zionism from within its own country due to a variety of reasons. Rather, it has been a staunch supporter of Hezbollah in Lebanon, both through supporting it financially, diplomatically, and also militarily. And that, I believe, is one of the main reasons that there is this attention against it, because it represents a symbol of resistance more than itself is a resistance. It represents that symbol of resistance.
You know, one thing that I've been hearing people say is that what the empire wants to do is basically destabilize the entire Middle East, kind of break up nations, like break up Iraq, break up Syria, so you have a whole lot of little mini-states, which presumably would be weaker, which would leave Israel and maybe Saudi Arabia as the big strong powers in that region. Do you think that is...
That could happen. Mm-hmm. Syria could be cut up into different statelets, and particularly when people that support a bombing campaign bring up Yugoslavia as a positive example. And we saw how Yugoslavia was cut up into Bosnia and Serbia and Kosovo. And so to do that to Syria would be quite detrimental, but it would fit within the historic actions of these colonial powers, because if we remember Sykes-Picot agreement and the division of Lebanon and Palestine and Syria itself, because these borders are artificially constructed by foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
So they may also want to divide Syria even further. And we've seen rumblings of that by some of these rebels are calling for different emirate states in Syria. Myself, as a member of that region, I find that to be the most horrific consequence of a bombing campaign and of further division in Syria right now.
What would that do? What would that be like? It's actually living there.
If that were to happen, that we would have Syria broken up even further, then the aspect of the reunification becomes extraordinarily difficult and unlikely. And in the process of it being broken up, and it being led by these different religious factions. And I personally am opposed to religious leadership in government, regardless of their religion, because one cannot really hold a discussion with people who claim to have the ear of God. It ends the discussion right there. And so the moment that we have a religious government, it opens the floodways for numerous different kinds of oppressive and repressive behaviors. I don't believe that any religious authority can be in a political position and not then have a great potential to inflict harm on its population. And that becomes an additional worry as to what could happen to Syria if it is broken down even further.
Yeah, well, we're coming to the end of our show, and we've been talking with Rania Masri, who is a professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Balamand in Lebanon, and is currently visiting the U.S. How long will you be in the U.S.?
A few more weeks, and then I head back to Lebanon, where I resume my academic position.
And this is in Beirut. Is that where you live?
I live in Beirut, and I work a little bit south of Tripoli at a university in the north, yeah.
Do you ever run into Franklin Lamb?
I do run into Franklin Lamb.
Oh, well, he's interesting. You know, he actually comes from the Portland area.
Yes.
He grew up in Milwaukee, Oregon, and we hear about it from him now and then. And so,
yeah, it's a small world.
It is. Well, okay, I want to really thank you very much for being with us. And, it's just keep, I've been hearing you on Democracy Now! And other shows, and I hope we will hear much more from you in the future. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time and your energy on these issues.
Well, this has been Political Perspectives. We have been covering the ongoing war in Syria, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Aladdin Theater, presenting Lee Fields and the Expressions with Brownish Black and DJ Stephen Cray from KMHD's Drop Shop, September 16th at 8 p.m. Tickets and information for Lee Fields and the Expressions on September 16th at aladdin-theater.com. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9:59. Coming up at 10 o'clock is Air Cascadia with your host, Chris Andre.
The KBOO Board of Directors elections are underway. KABU members can vote for up to four candidates. Ballots were mailed in mid-August. If you think you are a KABU member and have not received a ballot, email membership director Andrew Geller at membership@kabu.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Non-members can join KABU and receive a ballot to vote. Just go to kboo.fm and click donate on the top right-hand corner. The annual meeting is Sunday, September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Community Center at 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. You can mail back your ballot or bring it to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Ballots must be postmarked by September 10th or cast at the annual meeting by 2:40 p.m. to count. Get informed, get involved, and vote. Thanks.
Hi, this is Ren Green with the latest episode of my KABU podcast, Experience Points. This week, I talked with bipolar peer support specialist Gina Wheeler about mental illness and peer counseling.
I just want everybody that has a mental illness to know that there is more out there than just that medical model, that there's hope, there's help, there's support, and tapping into that community, you can really find how to live your life.